you have any questions about Hinduism?
How does the wheel stand for that now?
I'm not too sure on that particular point. The prayer wheel is more associated with Buddhism than with Hinduism.
Well, the wheel of karma, I thought, just meant that it goes around in this endless circle of fire.
Yes, until you stop the resolution.
Yes.
Do they have any concept of a deliverer or a messiah?
No. Hinduism does have the concept of atavars. Vishnu incarnates. And a broad-minded Hindu would blandly accept Christ as an incarnation of Vishnu. He'd say, that's perfectly right. We understand this. Hinduism will adopt anything. Hinduism won't fight with a religion. It absorbs it. Yes?
There is a place in the book that tells of a kind of Trinity belief among the early Hindus.
Yes, that's Agni. Agni, the god of fire.
Vedic age, yes.
We're not talking about the history of Hinduism.
The present.
Right. The early Vedic scriptures present a pantheon of gods headed up by Dayus Pitar, the sky god. And this Dayus is the same root word as the word Zeus and the word deity. If you will think back, this goes back to Turkestan and to the Andites and to the spread of the Andites westward into Greece and eastward into India and southward into Persia. All of these religions have affinities in Persia as in India. You receive the spirit of divinity by drinking soma, and soma was undoubtedly an intoxicating drink. And if you don't understand the physiology of alcohol, you could get quite you could confuse being spiritual with being spiritus. It's the same root word. In the Hindu scriptures, you have roughly several levels. You've got the Vedas, which were written down many, many years afterwards. And some of the most wonderful hymns in praise of God are in the Vedas. This is good reading. And then you have the Brahmanas, which are this is Deuteronomy, Leviticus, all kinds of rules and regulations. These are the priestly codes. How do you perform this operation? How do you perform that operation? They're pretty deadly dull reading. Still later, you have a monistic reaction against so many deities. Agni goes back to the Vedic era, three-headed Agni. And the three heads are what's left of the Trinity concept taught by the Adamson people, by the Adamites. This later appearing monistic reaction produced some of the most intriguing philosophic writings that have ever been reduced. Schopenhauer referred to them as the comfort of his soul. They are the Upanishads. And Hume has published a book, a translation, The 13 Principal Upanishads. And I think if this society had a library, I would recommend you buy it for your library. Upanishads. Upanishads. They're philosophic discourses on the nature of reality. This is not easy reading.
David Hume?
Yes, the same Hume that did the Treasure House. He's the translator. And then you have the epics in Hinduism. And perhaps the greatest of these epics is the Mahabharata. And within the Mahabharata, these things are Homeric in type, is one of the most beautiful things in Hinduism called the Bhagavad Gita, sometimes referred to as the New Testament of Hinduism. The Bhagavad Gita is the story of one of the incarnations of Vishnu and of the ethic which he preaches to, I've forgotten the name of the principal character, he's a warrior, and Vishnu is his charioteer. And
Arjuna,
yeah. This dialogue is a good example of the ethic of Hinduism. And basically, it's an acceptance of where you are. Arjuna does not want to fight. He doesn't want to kill these people, but Vishnu tells him, but you are a warrior. This is your fate, your karma.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the most intriguing religions because you can find everything from soup to nuts in Hinduism. I read stuff in Hinduism that I just get excited about, and I read about practices that are revolting. Yes.
Do they ever stop finding those will find heaven?
What's that?
Do they ever stop and go to a good heaven in case they've been good all the way through?
There are heavens in Hinduism, but they're temporary places. In other words, let's say that in this life, you really were good, and they check you out, and you haven't got it made yet. You can't vanish into the Brahman, but you're too good even to come back as a Raja. You might have your next incarnation in some Hindu heaven, but this too is illusory, just as illusory as is the world. Your final goal is to find unity with the Brahman as a drop of water joins the ocean. The Hindu teaching of heaven is exactly the same as the Urantian teaching of annihilation. The personality finds union with the Supreme and is not. The Atman finds union with the Brahman and is not.
How does that attract them?
They don't suffer.
This is final peace. You believe this.
Oh, you don't suffer. There you are.
In Hinduism, God is everywhere. There is no place where God is not, or the Absolute is everywhere. And a good example is a story they tell about a little Hindu boy who's talking to his teacher. And he says, but teacher, if Brahman is in me, and if Brahman is everywhere, then why did Brahman the elephant almost run Brahman the me down the other day? And the teacher, by a slippery device, said, ah yes, it's true. But did not you, who is Brahma, see Brahma riding on top of the elephant, warning you, Brahma, to get out of the way of Brahma the elephant? There was a mahout on top of the elephant. Hinduism is polytheistic. In its lower levels, Hinduism is demonistic. The place is full of demons. In its higher levels, it's polytheistic. In its upper levels, you find the Trimurti, not a trinity. For example, Vishnu and Kali are working at swords points. Vishnu and Shiva. If Shiva is the destroyer and Vishnu is the preserver, this is not cooperation. At its highest levels, Hinduism is monistic, but not monotheistic. And it's all of these things at the same time. Yes?
Well, as India gets more and more civilized, well, maybe I mean Western civilization, I don't know.
India will not accept Western civilization, Helene.
Oh.
India sees too much that's wrong with Western civilization.
Well, they're trying something. They're having their manufacturing. They're doing all kinds of things.
India will accept our techniques, but not our culture.
Well, is their religion going to grow better or not?
I don't know. I hope the Urantia book is the answer to that question.
You know what they say about, the Urantia book says about the Christian religion in relation to the Orient. It's a strange religion for strangers.
Christianity is hopelessly compromised with the non-white man's resentment of the fact that the white man has dominated this world for the last 100 years. The white man had the military armament, and they used it. Most people do that. There's one other thing about Hinduism that's a little hard for us to understand. A Hindu is an Indian, and they think of it as synonymous. There is a blurring of nationalism and membership in Hinduism. The word Hindu means something that the word Christian does not mean in the West. You're an American, a German, a Swede, a Swiss, but a Hindu is an inhabitant of the subcontinent of India as well as a member of a religious body.
Is it almost 100%?
Virtually, yes.
It's strange that Nathaniel didn't leave any imprint, any place there.
Well, he may have stirred some things up.
Missionaries point out a place where Thomas got to,
yes.
The Apostle Thomas in India.
But he didn't.
No, I know, but maybe that was Nathaniel.
Maybe that was Nathaniel. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stories going around about Jesus in India, and these could have been the imprint that the apostles.
And of course, there was Gained over there too. Well, should we talk about the two heresies that arose in India? The first one is Jainism, sometimes called Saduanism, and it was founded by a teacher by the name of Mahavira in the 6th century BC. And it was a semi-protest against Hinduism. Its most peculiar feature is that it looked upon life exactly as Albert Schweitzer looks upon life, that all living things are important. And an extreme Jainist will actually wear surgical gauze on his across his breathing equipment, lest he destroy inadvertently some microorganism. They will eat vegetables only. They've got their cosmology. If you think the cosmology in the Arantia book is tough, you take a look at the cosmology of Hinduism or Jainism. These people have got heavens within heavens within heavens within heavens. They've got big cycles turning little cycles. These cycles are turning smaller cycles, and the small cycles are awfully long. They have numbers as big as the numbers in the Urantia book. These features of the Urantia book, which are foreign to Christian thinking, are going to be one of the most appealing things about this book to a Jainist, to a Hindu, to a Buddhist. This book is written to appeal to those people as well as to us. Jainism isn't very big. If my memory serves me, Jainism is about 5 million or so in India. And in a population the size of India, this is not much. The other heresy was founded by Gautama Siddhartha. And in the founding of it, he became known as the Buddha. And the word Buddha is exactly like the word Christ. It's a title. The word Christ means the anointed one. The word Buddha means the enlightened one. Gautama never claimed too much. He never claimed to be a revelation of God. He did claim to be a revelation of truth. He protested against all of the ascetic practices of the Hindu, who by starving himself, by mortifying the flesh, was attempting to reduce this karma content, to reduce these tensions, and to break the cycle of rebirth. Gautama also taught a cycle of rebirth. The same notion is found in Buddhism that you have in Hinduism. The principle of karma causality. Buddha taught a religion of quiescence, of simply sitting down and putting the world out of your mind. I've told you the story of the three monks and the hare and the begging bowl. And when you finally achieve enlightenment, you look upon the world and you know it's nothing. In fact, you should go blind. Your whole sensory mechanism ought to be disconnected. There are considerable elements of this in Zen Buddhism. Buddha taught a life of forsaking the world, the monk-like approach to salvation. He lived a life of service. As usual, his life was much greater than his teachings, as Jesus pointed out to Gained. The original ideal of Buddhism is the Arhat, A-R-A-T, I believe it is. This is the saffron-robed monk who, by denying everything, by renouncing all desire, finally escapes into the peace of Nirvana. And you say, where is Buddha? Buddha is in Nirvana. Is Buddha conscious? No. Is Buddha unconscious? No. Is Buddha alive? No. Is Buddha dead? No. Does Buddha know I'm here? No. Does Buddha not know I'm here? No. This is the nitta, natta answer. Not this, not that. All you can say about Buddha is no. Nirvana is not the absolute, in the same sense that the Brahman is the absolute of Hinduism. But functionally, nirvana is the absolute. And when you reach nirvana, you have passed into the oversoul of creation. This form of Buddhism persisted in India until, well, there's another one that came in too. It died out about 600 AD. It lasted about 1200 years. It produced one of the greatest rulers who ever lived, a man who was ranked next to Moses as the outstanding spiritual character between the days of Melchizedek and the times of Jesus. This man was Asoka, and he ruled over a temporarily united India. He was one of the successors of those who resisted Alexander and his successors when they invaded India, late in the 300s BC. I've forgotten when this was, about 320, let's say. So that would put Asoka in the 3rd century BC. And here was a great emperor ruling a very powerful state, and he renounced war. And all over India, he put up these markers renouncing war. This is a man who could have conquered much more, but he believed the teachings of Buddha, and it produced peace in India. That's an unusual thing for an emperor to do. The evolution of Buddhism is, to me, fascinating, second only to the growth of Christianity, because Buddhism has grown. Buddhism entered a period of fermentation late in the first century AD in an area which would now be best described as Pakistan, Afghanistan, Russian and Chinese Turkestan. In other words, it comes up on this side of India, as does Pakistan. We take in the Kashmir, includes Afghanistan, crosses the mountains into Russia, and then turns east into China. It's built like a boomerang. And that eastward turning is very important, because this country, ruled by the Kushans, contested this eastward turning with the Chinese. This is the Tarim Basin, up north of Tibet. And it was probably a little more fertile then than now. And it was a gateway to China. It was one of the gateways between the East and the West. It's how Buddhism entered China. Let's consider the dominions of the Kushans, because they're fascinating.
I'll draw it for you.
I'll draw it for you. Here.
Where are the Himalayas?
Here's Arabia, the Red Sea, the Persian Gulf, poorly drawn, India, Ceylon. Over here's Burma. And the Himalayas are up and through here. And the dominions of the Kushans extended over and about like so.
Oh, above
the Himalayas.
Oh, okay.
Those Asoka's missionaries.
Do you know something that you ought to really do? You ought to look at a geography long enough until you can shut your eyes and see any map of any part of the world adequately. It's so handy. You never get lost then. Then you know where you are.
Can you do that, Jeff?
Yes. Not too well, but enough. Let's consider this domain. There's some interesting things are boiling. Alexander's empire extended across the Indus River. And after the Battle of Ipsus, which was about 310 or thereabouts, this is when it was finally determined that it was going to break up. The guys fighting to hold it together got roundly trounced. And so they split it up into three units. There was Macedon in Europe. A general by the name of Ptolemy, who was one of the ancestors of Cleo, got Egypt and the Palestine coast. And a guy by the name of Seleucus got the rest of it, extending way out here into Asia, roughly the old Persian Empire. And it's called the Empire of the Seleucidae. And they alternated between the name of Seleucus and Antiochus. Antioch was named for one of these rulers. They tried to hold things together, but it was a little too difficult. And along about 220 BC, the extreme end of this empire broke off and became the kingdom of Bactria. And it was a poor man's version of Magna Graecia. It was the easternmost outpost of Hellenistic culture. And these Bactrians maintained things for a while.
Were they largely Greek?
Yes, a lot of
Alexander's army.
Yes, and Macedonians, and settlers who came in for 100 years afterwards. Greece poured people out, like Europe poured people out. This whole area was dotted with Greek cities. In other words, the circumstances of events were preparing the way for the spread of Jesus' teachings east as well as west. There was a thin latticework of Hellenistic culture that extended beyond the Indus, because the greatest of the Bactrian kings was a guy by the name of Menander, and he whacked out a big empire on the Indian side of the Indus, south of the Himalayas. He lost Afghanistan to the nomads, the predecessors of the Kushans. And about 50 AD, more or less, the whole Greek political structure finally collapsed. And the Kushans, who were semi-civilized barbarians, about like the Goths were when they moved into the Roman Empire. They weren't complete barbarians. They had a veneer. These Kushans took this area over, and they held the northern hinterland where they'd come from. These Kushans were theologically neutral rulers. They weren't Buddhists. They weren't Hindus. And in this area, it was possible for something new to happen. And here we have Hinduism fermenting, we have Buddhism fermenting, and we have the ragtag end of Hellenistic culture fermenting. And this is where the Gospel of Jesus should have found its Asiatic vehicle, a vehicle which would have been to it exactly what Judaism and Greek philosophy was in the West. But they weren't there. Stiff-necked Abner not only broke up Hermia, but he didn't have any boys out there in the Kushan domains with the good news. This is where Mahayana Buddhism evolved, in contrast to the older form of Buddhism, which is called Hinayana Buddhism. Hinayana means little vehicle. Mahayana means great vehicle. This is where the life of Buddha triumphed over the teachings of Buddha. Mahayana Buddhism developed a God concept. Mahayana Buddhism also developed a lot of ritual. All of the ritual in Tibet is a modification of Mahayana Buddhism. Mahayana Buddhism died in India but lived in China. It spread north of the Himalayas, and India for a while was the holy land of the Chinese Buddhists. And Chinese would brave the waters and the deserts to go down to India and visit this holy land. Sanskrit was the original holy script of Buddhism in China, not for long. Mahayana Buddhism, I would rate as the second best religion on earth. Mahayana Buddhism is a very appealing Buddhism. It exists on all levels. You can get a lot of superstitious practice in Mahayana Buddhism. But in the upper level, you have a concept of truth plus tolerance. The one thing about Buddhism that appeals to me more than Christianity is, it is a much more tolerant religion. Mahayana Buddhism teaches, oh, it's got devils and demons for the peasants, and as you move up topside, it has the incarnations of the Buddha, and there are many of them, scores of them, hundreds of them, thousands of them, millions of them, until there are so many that polytheism vanishes before the emerging concept of the principle that's incarnated. And this is the eternal Buddha. In other words, you got the thing, so polytheistic, it became monotheistic again. Buddhism, in its highest reaches, is a monotheistic religion. Now, have I told you the story of the Protestant missionary in Pekin? It's one of my favorites. It's from James Pratt, Bishop Pratt's Pilgrimage of Buddhism. This Protestant missionary, around 1900, was visiting a Buddhist monastery in the environs of Pekin. And it was a very beautiful monastery. It had been there for hundreds of years. You can imagine what kind of lawns they had. You can imagine what kind of landscaping had taken place. In the old building, the stones were mellow with the dust of time. And this Protestant Christian missionary was responsive to aesthetic values, and he was quite enthusiastic. And his enthusiasm reached such a point that the abbot was so pleased that when they passed the central sanctuary, the abbot said to him, "My friend, would you like to come in and burn some incense to the Buddha?" And the missionary looked at him and he said, "My good sir, you don't realize you and I worship different gods." And the abbot looked a moment, and he smiled, and he said, "But how can that be? There is only one God." This is the one thing that would have made Buddhism extremely attractive to me, is that tolerance, that realization that there is only one, regardless of what you call it. I heard Kagawa talk in the Methodist Temple in Chicago many years ago. Kagawa is a very fine Christian. He's unique in the sense that he won't take money for his religious activities, so no one can tell him what to do. And I heard Kagawa say, if you send missionaries to Japan, don't send theologians, because the Buddhists have got about as good a theology we've got. If these missionaries do not have the Spirit of Christ in their hearts, they're utterly useless to us. Now, what is the theology of Mahayana Buddhism at its best? The papers say that the fastest growing religious group today in the world is the Shin sect of Buddhism in Japan. They do not give that accolade to a Christian group. In Buddhism, in the Mahayana, the monk is not the hero. It is the server of all. In other words, the hero here is patterned after the life of Buddha, not his teachings. And if you want the name for that, he is a bodhisattva, or an aspirant to the level of finality. The greatest of the bodhisattvas is a being by the name of Amida. Amitabha is a different form of that same name. It's hard to read Buddhism because, well, it's like in the West, we're more used to it. Theodoric can be Theodore or Dietrich. They're all the same name, you know. But you couldn't hardly say Theodore the Great and think of the Ostrogoth who went into Italy, you know. That's got to be Theodoric. This bodhisattva had completed all the requirements of entry into Nirvana. He was at the threshold. And then he turned back, and he looked over his shoulder, and he saw all of the struggle for happiness and peace going on earth. And he vowed a vow that he would never enter Nirvana until the last human being had made the grave. And this theology teaches that if you pray to Amida, and if you're virtuous, Amida will heed your prayers. He will help you. This religion has even a goddess of mercy, like Mother Mary, and her name is Kuan Yin. And my mother had a statue of Kuan Yin, the goddess of mercy in Buddhism. It's a pretty fine religion. It's lasted a long time. And I can see no reason why Mahayana Buddhism should not serve just as well as a background for the teachings of Jesus as any other religion. Toynbee, in his evaluation of religion today, says there are only two really good religions on earth, Christianity and the Mahayana, and neither of them is good enough to do the job. This is the second greatest religion that's ever appeared on earth, I think. Questions about the Mahayana?
Well, I was wondering why the established organization of Mahayana Buddhism wouldn't represent as stable and immovable vested interests as the ecclesiastical structure of Christianity.
It's not as big.
And therefore,
there's no central structure.
Be an obstacle.
It will be. It will be. But I think people may find something in this blue book that they don't find in Christianity. Zen Buddhism, in contrast to Shin, has more of the contemplative side of Buddhism. And then there's the Lotus sect and the Pure Land sect and many. There are different churches in Buddhism, just as there are in Christianity. When you think of Zen versus Shin, you're thinking of Congregationalists versus Episcopalians, let's say. While we're in Japan, we can dispose of Shinto. It's more of a codified patriotism today than a religion. It's very similar to emperor worship in the days of Rome, which was hardly worship. It was more of a formality you went through to declare your solidarity with a Roman state. Shinto, I think we can pass over as something which has become much more of a quasi-religious patriotism than a true religion. It's the official religion of Japan. But Japan actually is a Buddhist country. Let's take up Confucius, as long as we've gone east. I think the teachings of Confucius sustain the same relationship to Buddhism in the east that the teachings of Socrates sustained Christianity in the West. Plato evidently did teach what Socrates taught, because these papers say that in the West we are nominally Christians in our religion and Socratic in our philosophy. I would say that in the East people are mostly Buddhists in their religion and Confucian in their ethics. Confucius did not teach a religion or a philosophy. He taught an ethic. The God concept in Confucianism is not at all clear. The concept of God is presented more as the concept of a heavenly order. The word great heaven is